Do you like music?
It's rich, it's alive, it's vivid. Stereophonic sound.
Are you fed up with constantly searching for the records you want?
Fame, fortune, platinum records. It's every boy's dream.
Every one of my records means something. The label, the producer, the year it was made.
I'm teaching you about rock music.
Seriously, you're totally elitist. You feel like the unappreciated scholars.
Okay, let's spin a disc.
Howdy, Cut by Cut fans. We are back and in full swing. This is episode 40, kicking off season 4 of Cut by Cut. And this time around, we're going to go back to basics. We're going to be bringing you back every Tuesday some half-hour shows where we dive head first into the shallow end of some of music's most amazing albums. And what we're going to talk about over the next couple weeks is the much maligned and much celebrated, the much vindicated and the most vicious and the most adjective attitudinal. This is why I was never good in the field of hip-hop. Beastie Boys, Paul's Boutique, released in July of 1989. This album is going to be celebrating its 30th anniversary soon, its 30th birthday, if you will. And joining me on this quest,
all right,
as always, is my man on the mic, Chris Buck Boom Boom Saint Sauveur.
Every episode we should add a middle a nickname.
It'll just get longer and longer, baby. So how you doing, man?
We're good. I am good.
Yeah, that's good
I
to hear.
You're good. Yeah, doing all right.
It's all right. it's you know,
The hiatus is over.
I was kind of hoping that, you know, a little time away from the studio would help the heat pass. That we would return and that we could actually sit in a room and not like be half naked and covered in sweat recording an episode.
Well, we're not half naked. We're all naked.
Yes.
For all the ladies, that is.
This episode, rated R. So we started talking and throwing down ideas for the next season. We wanted to kind of take it back a few steps, back to our sort of our original mission statement, which was to take an album and dice it up cut by cut. Over our hiatus, you may not know this, but we got a lot of, you know, some cool emails and stuff like that.
Oh.
And so people, you know, obviously really enjoyed the music episodes.
Good.
Yeah. How did you dig it?
So I had a lot of fun. I personally had a lot of fun being a fan of our own podcast in a way. That might sound a little weird, but you know, I would do my episode and look forward to yours, and then we had Brooke and other Chris do episodes, and it's fun looking forward to those.
Yeah, the right man didn't know what the left man was doing.
Yeah. We had a couple of conversations where I would have put out an episode, and you'd be like, I can't believe you used that track.
Yeah, it was good to be on the same sort of mental scope.
Because we didn't want to use the same tracks, but artists, right?
Like, right. Well, I haven't seen you also in forever, it feels like. I mean, even just in real life, not just in podcast life. But, you know, we took the good hiatus.
And there were actual vacations that happened, you know,
in
various places with different groups of people, right?
And I like the idea. I don't know if you can hear this, folks, but here in New England, it's been easily 120 degrees for 4 months.
I cooked an egg on my forehead today.
It has not rained. You know what? Put a pin in that, because we'll be talking about egg tossing a little later on.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's been oppressive. And so you can hear the choir of crickets, I think. It's why I keep playing the instrumental to All the Girls underneath it, so that maybe the crickets sound as if they're helping us out. You know, it's our people. It's our audience.
What's a little cricket between podcast hosts and their audience.
A lot.
Maybe in its own right would be oppressive.
I've actually taken to sleeping with earplugs in.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't know what happened. As I'm getting older, I can't do it anymore.
Get
man.
Off my lawn, crickets.
Yeah. It's more for the air conditioner. I hate that hum.
Oh, okay.
It does not sit
what I
well
hate?
With me.
Nazis? Sleeping on the side of the bed that the air conditioner is on.
Oh, really?
That's my side of the bed.
So it blows on you and you don't care for that?
I'm the buffer so that Brooke does not take
the blunt of part the brunt of the...
I guess part of my husbandly duties is to be the... yeah, what do you call that in... The breaker wall.
Yeah, sure. So we're looking at, where... Do you remember where you were when you first heard the Beastie Boys?
Yes.
Okay.
I was in my parents' basement where we had our, for lack of a better term, playroom, because I was little when they finished it.
Yeah.
And as I grew older, it was probably Sabotage, actually. So it's later Beastie Boys.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was probably an MTV video.
All right.
Down in my...
Sabotage?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was lucky enough that I had some cousins who were in college. And so one of my cousins was super into the Def Jam catalog. You know, he was like into LL Cool J, but he was also into things like Eric B. and Rakim.
I hear ladies love.
Yeah, his hat is like a shark fin, I think. And so he came home maybe for Christmas 1 year with this album, and my mother was immediately appalled by the album art.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this crashed airplane on License to Ill that when you opened it was clearly a blunt that somebody a joint that somebody had put out that's shaped like an airplane. So it offended on multiple levels, and my mom, a child of the 60s, knew what she was looking at. There was no deceiving Judy on this one. And she forbade me, which was weird because at the time I was listening to like the Sex Pistols and the Misfits and Suicidal Tendencies.
Sure.
So that, but I think she was more upset. She was, because at the time rap was getting a pretty terrible, Newsweek and Time and stuff like this was coming out with these articles about how terrible hip hop was.
Like the culture.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, it was just racist bullshit because,
The perception of violence, right? Because all it's about, whatever. It has a level of vulgarity to it, but I'll call it, honesty, I guess, in a way.
And at the time, I remember Time Magazine was, or Newsweek, I could be one of the two, was striking out against, Sista Soulja and Public Enemy.
Yeah.
So they were on the cover almost every week. Like, can you believe that these people, these Nouveau Black Panthers? And it's funny because my mom in the 60s was part of the civil rights movement. My dad was a huge, they were both capital L liberal. And it wasn't the fact that they were preaching black power or telling it like it was from the city. I think it was just, you're not old enough to know what you're getting into.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
The other stuff that I was listening to was kind of just nonsense. Like the Sex Pistols were just nonsense. And so they weren't really afraid of that. So,
Nobody takes the British seriously.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm just kidding.
Hundreds of thousands of years. So my cousin made me a copy of License to Ill. And as I was leaving Christmas, he slipped it to me. He was like, here, take this. And
nice.
Yeah, it was awesome. And so I walked around school the next week. Like everybody who I knew, I was throwing my headphones on their ears. Just like, you have to hear this album. It's amazing. And actually, no, I'm lying to you. I was in seventh grade. So I'm throwing this album on everyone's heads and people are like, this is garbage. This is terrible. It's like Motley Crue was really big.
Yeah,
Guns
yeah,
N' Roses right. were coming out and they were huge.
Yep.
And then I remember that February we went to Florida and I think I've told these stories before about like my parents used to limit us to what we could bring.
Yeah, was that the Morrissey trip?
That might have been the Morrissey trip. But we went to like, at one point, we went to like the mall. And I ended up buying the some 7-inch of theirs, some single. And I don't remember what it was. And my grandma had an old, you know, an old turntable, but it was like one of the ones that's like built into furniture.
Sure, yeah.
And I played, I forget it what it was. It was off the License to Ill, but I played it over and over and over. Oh, Paul Revere.
Did it have a B-side?
Yeah, it was Paul Revere backed with, and I don't remember what the other side was. But anyway, I played the living hell out of it. And my mom basically just was like, well, I've lost this fight.
She gave in, did she?
Yeah, oh. Yeah. My dad was like, it's as harmless as everything else. Don't worry about it. He's, smart kid with a good head on his shoulders.
What's the worst that could happen?
Yeah, exactly. I'm a public school teacher. I let them down. But, so, the Beasties finish License to Ill. License to Ill had 7 singles.
Yep.
It entered the charts at number 18, but it was the first rap album to ever hit number 1. It went platinum 4 months after it was originally out.
Yep.
And they were basically branded as one-hit wonders because of this sort of frat rock fight for your right to party song.
Sure, yep.
Do you remember hearing that for the first time?
I think like when you asked me when I first, I think I had probably already heard that song. I just, when I, when I talk about Sabotage, that was like when they entered like my culture, if you
yeah,
know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, that song's everywhere, right? That was a ubiquitous song pretty fast. Like you said, 4 months and it went platinum. Yep. So I just don't know where I would have like, what year was License to Ill? 88? Eight? Was it 88? Just a year before?
No, 2 years.
Because they spent a little time in purgatory between albums,
86, 87?
Right? Yeah, so I was 5, I was 6.
Look, I only studied this album, and I didn't realize it'd be a quiz on the rest of
you brought discography. You brought it up. I was 9 years old in 89.
Yep.
So.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. But this, so. It probably wasn't bumping at the St. Silver.
I had probably heard it. Again, MTV was in my house.
Yep.
At some point.
Yeah,
I don't. Maybe not. My grandparents had cable. That was. I would go to their house and watch cable TV.
Yeah.
So, I can remember watching like Peter Gabriel videos. Scared the shit out of me. Like the Reagan puppet, And
those that was Genesis. Actually,
that was Genesis. Oh, okay.
Land of Confusion. Yes. With the, yeah. No, those puppets were horrifying.
It was. I had nightmares.
And I actually kind of feel like, remember at the end of that video with Ronald Reagan and he wakes up in the thing of sweat. That's exactly how I feel right now.
Right now.
That is 100%. I feel like Ronald Reagan ball sweat right now. We might title the show Ronald Reagan's ball sweat. So anyway. Yeah, so the
fight for your right to party, everybody knows that.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's
if you don't come on, join us, crawl out from under the rock.
So yeah. Let's go, where we are right now. Let's go 2 years into the future-ish, to 1989. And the release of the building up of Paul's Boutique. So Def Jam, they're having all kinds of problems with Def Jam. Russell Simmons reportedly withheld something like $2 million, which by today's standards is like, 20 or $25 million. Like
is it that much?
Yeah, it's massive.
Compounded there, yeah.
Yeah. And so you have these three guys.
They would have had to have invested it right. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's exactly what
compounded money. Compounding money from like that for me, like in today's dollars, kind of stuff is like it's weird to me because because
they were really money conscious, and so once we start getting into the album, we'll talk about how thrifty they were and just how the Beasties just really put it away for themselves. So the dramatic personae, the dramatis personae, or the list of characters, we've got Mike D, right, Mike Diamond. We've got Ad Rock, Adam Horovitz. We got Adam Yauch, MCA. We've got Matt Dyke, who was a DJ, producer, sort of the, at the time, king of L.A.
His apartment is where this album was recorded.
I believe so, right? Yes. Yeah. And so he had come from the East Coast, where he was Jean-Michel Basquiat's assistant for 4 years. And so you may know Basquiat as being part of Warhol's factory.
I might.
He was a graffiti artist. He was one of the first to really break through with that. Most people, I think, of this right now who don't know anything about Warhol or the factory would know him. Have you seen the Luke Cage television show.
Oh, yeah.
When the woman takes over, I forget her name, when she takes over the club and she has that painting with the two crowns on it to replace the biggie one, that's a Basquiat.
Oh, okay.
So
they even, they call it that, the Basquiat. They think.
Right, yeah. And the idea being hopefully that people would get it, but I don't think a lot of people probably do. And I'm not saying that people are dumb. I'm just saying.
I think that show, I think, not to get off too much, but that show is the second season I became aware only because some of the references they made actually were relevant to me. Like, or not relevant, but I caught them.
Yeah.
You know that, yeah, we talked about this before. You can listen to something and not understand that everything you're hearing or seeing are cues or references to things.
Yep.
And you're oblivious. So I think if you go back, or maybe there's wikis at this point, but I just assume everything I'm looking at now in these shows is a reference to something.
Yeah.
That I just don't get.
And that's the glory of Paul's Boutique. You know, we're going to be talking about this album that is so fucking thick.
Yeah. 100 and the album was, where'd it go? Bear with me. Come on, Chris.
All right, well, while you're doing that, so the...
I think it was something like 104 different samples.
Mostly provided by the Dust Brothers, right?
Yeah.
John King and Mike Simpson.
Yeah.
And so the Dust Brothers were, you know, working out in L.A., and they were taking hip-hop and punk and country and, you know, pop music, and jazz, they were just creating layered samples.
They were taking everything.
Yeah.
Literally everything.
And I'm really glad that there are people who have that kind of ear, right? Because as we're going to explore as we go through the season, this is the album that killed samples. They wanted this to be, you know, they wanted this to be the pinnacle of sampling in music. They wanted this to be the high water mark.
Yeah, they did it. They spent a lot of their budget on the samples, but as far as the industry goes, if they were to do that today with the songs they picked, the price would have been they would have been priced out of doing this.
Right.
No one would spend the money they would have to spend to do it.
And that's been pretty much my take on hip hop is since DJing has died, or, you know, since DJing has stopped being about samples and being about this depth and this understanding of the music and this enrichment process. Mostly now, it's just beats. It's just people hitting.
Well, that's the DJs became the EDM guys.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Because it's kind of just no. You can't really like copyright or trademark like.
Yeah.
Wah, blah, 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 you know.
Right. Right. Noise.
Noise.
Noise. And you know, yes, it's sound. So the Dust Brothers found themselves working for like Tone Loc and Young MC because they're. Their beats were so layered that the only it took precision to rap over them.
Yeah.
You had to know exactly what you were doing, and even Tone Loc and Young MC were like, these are too complicated
right.
for us.
So, yeah, they a lot of the tracks that they were used that Beastie Boys end up or that were done when they first heard them.
Yep.
They were like, "Oh, no, you don't want these. Nobody does. They're too dense." Right?
Yeah.
And they were like, "Nah, we can do this."
Well, the first one being Shake Your Rump. That was the first track that they wrote, and the Beastie Boys wrote it in almost no time. Like all of this whole album was written lyrically in a matter of days.
Well, they were spent this time in kind of this little bit of a quagmire where they were held up from a litigious standpoint where they couldn't do a new album because Def Jam kind of had the rights to them. So until that all got sorted out, so they probably needed money.
Oh yeah.
and they had all this stuff they wanted to do, but again, Def Jam was considering them one-hit wonders. And so
and just holding back all of their money.
Yeah.
So you're right, you know, so Capitol signs them for $3 million for a two-record deal. And Shake Your Rump and Dust Joint were the first two songs that they wrote. And meanwhile, of course, the Beasties are going insane in L.A. You know, it's basically like, you know, they're in the Capitol Record building and the money frees. And suddenly you got three kids with And it, you know what it reminds me of? Do you ever see that movie, like, Brewster's Millions?
No.
So Richard Pryor plays, like, this down-on-his-luck dude who, you know, got, and this old guy dies, and he's like, you've got 2 days to spend $5 million. And Brewster just goes ballistic, and he's, like, just trying to spend and spend and spend. And really, like, that's what they were doing. So they do these things like they had an open audition, like pretend open auditions for music videos, and they got 500 girls in bikinis to just come in line and like just walk past them. There was a comedy club, right? The comedy store across the street. And that's when we talk about Eggman, they would just whip eggs.
From the top of the building. Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And I think one of the cool things about Paul's Boutique for me, one of the things that like got me hooked on it as a kid was it felt like I was part of their inside joke. Because when you get tracks like Eggman and Johnny Royale, these are all songs like Johnny Royale was like a homeless dude who lived on their steps in New York.
Like, you felt like if you went to New York, you would see Johnny Royale and you could be like walking down the sidewalk calling his name. Right?
Yeah, like I know this guy or I'm part of the Beastie's world. And of course, their world at this point was insane, right? They had been touring. They had toured with Run DMC on the Raisin Hell tour. They had, you know, I remember them, my ex-wife saw them play, and I forget who they had opened up for, and they had like girls for License to Ill dancing in cages, and one of the girls that they had was from like Allentown, and she danced in the cage. She then got crabs.
Nice.
Yeah, so like they were going around the country. You know, there's a couple lines in Paul's Boutique where it's like, had to get up and get the Jimmy protector, you know, and like, no dude, you weren't, like, you're doing this in case your mom listens to this album, let's be honest, because you're spreading STDs like nobody's business through most of America. And I don't want to
through most of America, like,
and I'm only, you know, so this one girl got an STD
from a
Beastie Boy. That's all I know, and I'm making this grand gesture.
I like the idea of Beastie Boys being the patients, like,
patient zero for crabs across America. So then they move into the G-Spot, which is this at Torreyson Drive, and the rent there was $11,000 a month. And of course, this is where most of the magic happens. Right, the owner's wife had this closet full of like vintage 1970s pimp wear.
Yeah. This is all the crazy costumes that they. Yeah.
And they just, you know, it was the wrong wardrobe for these dudes. Do you know what I'm saying? Like when you've got three kids who are so amazingly talented and so quick and so smart and so musically capable, to then give them such a focus like this, and it I honestly believe. I mean, my sort of pet theory is that this wardrobe shaped the album.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, the Dust Brothers had these amazing sort of disco and funk and, you know, these great beats. But I think that, in my mind at least, this clothing sort of got them into the headspace.
I like it.
And so here are the ingredients of Paul's Boutique. To make a Paul's Boutique, one needs a blue bong, okay. Indica, hash, LSD, coffee, whippets, cigarettes, wine, and then amazing beats.
Wine or wine?
Wine. Okay. Red wine. and most importantly, you know, the ultimate sample album. So this is, you know, you can see why so many, like, even the Beasties were kind of weird about this album, because it's very different from what they eventually became in Check Your Head, which is the next album.
So looking, you know, retrospectively back at it, it's been called like the Sgt. Pepper's
of hip-hop.
And for me, the personal reference I was making is Weezer's Pinkerton album. It's like the album they ignore, but it has some of like their richest stuff on it.
Totally. And the press, of course,
and the
fucking hated this album.
The
when
press
it came out.
The press hated it, and then the record labels gave up on it.
Yeah,
you know, like they just stop advertising it, and like, yeah, it's in the catalog, but like we'll move on to the next thing. So here's the funny thing, though. We talked about how it topped the chart, which was unprecedented, right? Went platinum in...
it took 2 years for Paul's Boutique to go platinum.
Yeah, it took 2 years to go platinum.
Yeah.
But, like, still, it went platinum.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, you know, here's the thing. Look, you know, we're running low on time, but it was... Yes, you're exactly right. It went platinum. But you weren't dealing with a digital age. So if you wanted Paul's Boutique, you had to go either buy the mixtape of it, right? Like the bootleg.
Yeah.
Or you went and bought it.
Yeah. Or ordered it from Columbia House or something like that.
Right. So you had to own the physical copy.
Yep.
Would this album, and this is something maybe we can explore as the season goes on, but do you think this album would go platinum if it came out today?
I don't know how to measure that anymore. That's the problem with the industry, that the industry's having, right?
Yeah. Well, we're just going to make it up.
It's on Spotify.
Yeah. Yeah, it's free to people. So, and of course, you know, you said earlier, this album couldn't have been made today.
Well, yeah, no, it wouldn't. It would have been stopped at the door by lawyers.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we want to use these songs, you know.
Yeah, you can pick, someone with the calculator going, pick two of the songs.
Yes.
And then go rewrite everything else.
Yeah, exactly. You can almost hear the sad trombone. Yeah. And then the lawyer going, that is trademarked. That'll cost you $400. Womp, womp. Yeah. Cha-ching.
Yeah, and when you get like, well, we'll get there. We're going to be talking. So as the season goes on here, we're going to talk about each song. We will be talking about most of the samples that they picked. In some cases, maybe not all of them, because there is over a dozen in some songs.
Yeah, right? No, there's no way we'll get to all the samples. There's no way we'll get to all the allusions. So if you want to hear us talk about something in particular, you know, you want us to rate our favorite allusions in the songs, our favorite lines, because, I mean, there's one thing the Beastie Boys, I think, have done more than almost any other hip-hop artist is create these lines that are tremendous. These just walk-away taglines.
Yep.
You know, I mean, my favorite of all of theirs being suckers write me checks and then they bounce. I reach into my pocket for the fresh amount. I mean, I absolutely love that. Or even better is... what is it? Rapping like life is a big commercial. Acting like life is a big commercial. No, you cannot rhyme commercial with commercial.
Beyonce did rhymes like that,
but it's
rhymed minute with minute or something.
Yeah,
like that,
but it's
right?
That kind of crap that forces people like Eminem to say things like "My palms are sweaty, throwing up mom's spaghetti." You know, this fear that you can't do this, and you shouldn't. It's a cop out. But when they do it. It comes at the tail end of all of these amazing one-liners, and it just becomes the mic drop. It becomes that, like, yeah, I did that. Screw you.
My favorite line so far about the album that they had.
Yeah.
They had at one point a lawsuit had been filed on behalf of the Beatles, and the line that one of them had was, "What's cooler than being sued by the Beatles?"
Right. Well, they were. They
so
were,
there was. This was a badge of honor to be sued by a lot of these people.
They came at this album really aggressively. Like, what they hired Layla Turcanato, who was at the time 21, to be their publicist.
Okay.
Right. So here they take this girl who's been in the hip hop scene. She's a B-girl. She's 21 years old. Clearly, they're in L.A. They could have found someone with more experience.
Sure.
But they grab her. They refused to do interviews and talk about License to Ill.
Yep.
Just flat out. And then on top of that, they refused, and at the time, which was suicide, basically, they refused to release a single. And so they kind of forced Capitol Records to release Hey Ladies as the single.
Sure.
And so,
so even then, like what I think is interesting, I mean, this obviously I don't think had impact the way that I think they hoped it would, but like you have people that like Radiohead doing things like just releasing it on like albums on their website, right?
Yeah.
And saying F this industry, it doesn't work for me. All it does is make them rich and I'm a cow, right? So
yeah.
Like, so it,
milk me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. You know, these guys, I mean, they coming at it. And I think it's worth noting that if for anyone who, kudos to anyone who may have jumped in on some of our previous episodes, where they were like a hardcore band in a couple, like couple iterations ago.
Oh, right? Yeah.
So, like,
well, at this point,
rewind like three, four years, and they were a four piece hardcore band opening up for the Bad Brains, you know, and the Misfits and stuff like that. So,
and then I forget who it was. I really want to say that it was Mike Diamond, Mike D, was playing with some of the guys from Bad Brains.
Yeah.
Before they went into during this hiatus.
Yeah.
And so it's not like they were just hanging out. Yeah. Like they were actually.
But the point I was making, I lost sight of it, but I'm back. These are some punk kids.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah.
Who you know, probably don't have the most respect for authority figures like the people in LA who are telling them what to do.
Right. You know? Yeah. No, totally. And so, you know, they shipped, just to sort of, you know, put a pin on this, they shipped 500,000 copies. And most of them sat. And I would love to be like, dude, I was on that first wave. Right. No, I wasn't. It was a year late. 91 was when I first heard this.
I definitely wasn't. I was probably watching Ghostbusters the cartoon.
Oh, man. Ghostbusters the cartoon was so good. Well, that sound means that we are coming to the end of episode one.
Little Beastie Boys, Paul's Boutique Primer.
Exactly. If you want to reach out to us and tickle our fancy with some letters,
all the ladies and all the fellas,
cutbycut@gmail.com. If you're at Radio Mutation and you're like, what the fuck is this?
What happened to my garage music?
Yes, I really apologize. We are Radio Mutation's only talk show, quite possibly for a reason. We're going to be back in 1 week's time talking about To All the Girls, the first track off of Paul's Boutique.
Oh, yeah.
Is that all you're going to say?
Yeah,
just all year?
That's all I got.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah!